Chapter 7. The Streets of Camelin. Elaine's entourage attracted plenty of attention as it rode through Camelin, along streets that rose and fell with the hills of the city. The golden lily on the breast of her fur-lined crimson cloak was sufficient to identify her for citizens of the capital, but she kept her hood back, framing her face, so the single golden rose on the coronet of the daughter heir was clearly visible. Not just Elaine, high seat of House Trakand, but Elaine, the daughter heir. Let everyone see and know. The domes of the new city glinted white and gold in the pale morning light, and icicles sparkled on the bare branches of the trees down the center of the main streets. Even nearing its zenith, the sun lacked warmth, despite a blessedly cloudless sky. Luckily, there was no wind today. The air was cold enough to frost her breath, yet with the paving stones cleared of snow, even on the narrower, twisting ways, the city was alive again, the streets full and bustling. Carters and wagon drivers, harnessed by their work as surely as the horses between the shafts, clutched their cloaks in resignation as they made slow passage through the throng. A huge water wagon rumbled by, empty by the sound, on its way to be refilled for fighting the too frequent arsons. A few hawkers and street peddlers braved the chill to cry their wares, but most folk hurried about their tasks, eager to be indoors as soon as possible. Not that hurrying meant moving very fast. The city bulged, its population swollen beyond that of Tarvalin. In such a swarm, even the few who were mounted moved no faster than a man could walk. In the whole morning she had seen only two or three carriages inching along the streets. If their passengers were not invalids, or facing miles ahead, they were fools. Everyone who saw her and her party paused at the very least, some pointing her out to others, or hoisting a child for a better view, so one day they could tell their own children they had seen her. Whether they said they had seen the future queen, or simply a woman who held the city for a time, was the question. Most people simply stared, but now and then a handful of voices cried out, "Trakand! Trakand!" or even, "Elaine and Andor!" as she passed. Better if there had been more cheering, yet silence was preferable to jeers. Andorans were outspoken folk, none more so than Camelinners. Rebellions had begun and queens lost their thrones because Camelinners voiced their displeasure in the streets. An icy thought that made Elaine shiver. Who holds Camelin holds Andor, the ancient saying went. It was not exactly true, as Rand had demonstrated, yet Camelin was Andor's heart. She had laid claim to the city. The lion banner and Trakand's silver keystone shared pride of place on the towers of the outer wall. But she did not yet hold the heart of Camelin, and that was far more important than holding stone and mortar. "They will all cheer me one day," she promised herself. "I will earn their acclaim." Today, though, the crowded ways felt lonely between those few upraised voices. She wished Avienda were there, just for her company, but Avienda saw no reason to climb onto a horse, simply to move about the city. Anyway, Elaine could feel her. It was different from the bond with Brigitta, yet she could feel her sister's presence in the city, like sensing an unseen person in the same room, and it was comforting. Her companions drew their own share of attention. After barely 3 years as Aes Sedai, Saritha's dark square face had not yet achieved agelessness, and she looked a prosperous merchant in her fine bronze-colored woolens with a large silver and sapphires brooch holding her cloak. Her warder, Ned Yarman, rode at her heels, and he certainly caught eyes. A tall, broad-shouldered young man with bright blue eyes and corn-yellow hair curling to his shoulders, he wore a shimmering warder's cloak that made him appear a disembodied head floating above a tall gray gelding that was not entirely there either, where the cloak draped its haunches. There was no mistaking what he was, or that his presence announced an Aes Sedai. The others, maintaining a circle around Elaine as they made a way through the crowd, attracted just as many eyes, though. 8 women in the red coats and burnished helmets and breastplates of the Queen's Guard were not something seen every day, or ever before come to that. She had chosen them out from the new recruits herself for that very reason. Their under-lieutenant, Kasela Razkofny, lean and hard as any Aiel maiden, was that rarity of rarities, a woman's merchant's guard, nearly 20 years in the trade, as she put it. Silver bells in her stocky roan gelding's mane named her Arafelin, though she was vague about her past. The only Andoran among the eight was a graying, placid-faced woman with wide shoulders, Denny Culford, who had kept order in a wagon-driver's tavern in Low Camelin, outside the walls, another rough and singular job for a woman. Denny did not yet know how to use the sword at her hip, but Brigitta said she had very quick hands and quicker eyes, and she was quite adept with the pace-long cudgel that hung opposite her sword. The remainder were hunters for the horn, disparate women, tall and short, slender and wide, dewy-eyed and gray-haired, with backgrounds as varied, though some were as discreet as Casella, and others clearly inflated their former station in life. Neither attitude was uncommon among hunters. They had leaped at the chance to be listed on the guard's roll, though. More importantly, they had passed Brigitta's close inspection. "These streets are not safe for you," Saritha said suddenly, heeling her chestnut up beside Elaine's black gelding. Fireheart almost managed to nip the sleek mare before Elaine reined his head away. The street was narrow here, compressing the crowd and forcing the guardswomen in closer around them. The brown sister's face pictured Aes Sedai composure, but apparent concern sharpened her tone. "Anything might happen in a crush like this. Remember who is staying at the Silver Swan, less than 2 miles from this spot. 10 sisters at one inn are not simply seeking their own for company. Elida might well have sent them." "She might not have, too," Elaine replied calmly, more calmly than she felt. A great many sisters seemed to be waiting on the side until the struggle between Elida and Egwene was over. 2 had departed the Silver Swan, and 3 more come just since her arrival in Camelin. That did not sound like a party sent on a mission, and none were Red Aja. Surely Elida would include Reds. Still, they were being watched as well as she could range, though she did not tell Saritha that. Elida very much wanted her, much more than she would want a runaway accepted, or one connected to Egwene and those Elida called rebels. Why, she could not quite understand. A queen who was Aes Sedai would be a great prize for the White Tower, but she would not become queen if she was snatched back to Tar Valon. For that matter, Elida had issued the order to bring her back by any means necessary long before there seemed any possibility she would assume the throne for many years to come. It was a puzzle she had fretted over more than once since Rhonda Macura slipped her that foul brew that dulled a woman's ability to channel. A very worrying puzzle, especially now she was announcing her location to the world. Her eyes lingered a moment on a black-haired woman in a blue cloak with her hood thrown back. The woman barely glanced at her before turning into a candlemaker's shop. A weighted cloth bag hung from her shoulder. Not an Aes Sedai, Elaine decided. Merely another woman who aged well, like Zaida. "In any case," she went on firmly, "I won't be penned up by fear of Elida." What were those sisters at the Silver Swan up to? Saritha snorted, and not very softly. She seemed about to roll her eyes, then thought better of it. Occasionally Elaine caught an odd look from one of the other sisters in the palace, doubtless thinking of how she had been raised. Yet on the surface, at least, they accepted her as Aes Sedai, acknowledged that she stood higher among them than any except Nynaeve. That was not enough to stop them speaking their minds, often more bluntly than they would have with a sister who stood where she did and had achieved the shawl in a more usual fashion. "Forget Elida, then," Saritha said, "and remember who else would like to have you in hand. One well-aimed rock and you are an unconscious bundle, easily carried away in the confusion." Did Saritha really have to tell her water was wet? Kidnapping other claimants to the throne was almost customary, after all. Every house that stood against her had supporters in Camelin watching for an opportunity, or she would have her slippers for her midday meal. Not that they could succeed, not so long as she could channel, but they would make the attempt given a chance. She had never thought that simply reaching Camelin provided safety. "If I don't dare leave the palace, Saritha, I will never get the people behind me," she said quietly. "I must be seen, out and about and unafraid." That was why she had 8 guards instead of the 50 Brigitta had wanted. The woman refused to grasp the realities of politics. Besides, they would need 2 well-aimed rocks with you here. Saritha snorted again, but Elaine did her best to ignore the other's obstinacy. She wished she could ignore the woman's presence, but that was impossible. She had more reason for this ride than being seen. Halwyn Norrie gave her facts and figures by the ream, though the first clerk's droning voice almost put her to sleep, yet she wanted to see for herself. Norrie could make a riot sound as lifeless as a report on the state of the city's cisterns or the expense of cleaning the sewers. The crowds were thick with foreigners, Kandori with forked beards and Ilianers with beards that left their upper lips bare, and Arafelin with silver bells in their braids, copper-skinned Domani, olive-skinned Altarans and dark Tyrans, Kyrianen who stood out for their short stature and pale skins. Some were merchants, caught by the sudden onset of winter or hoping to steal a jump on their competition, smooth-faced, puffed-up folk who knew that trade was the life's blood of nations, and every one of them claiming to be a major artery, even when betrayed by a poorly dyed coat or a brooch of brass and glass. Many of the people afoot had worn and ragged coats, breeches out at the knee, dresses with tattered hems, and threadbare cloaks or none at all. Those were refugees, either harried from their homes by war or sent wandering by the belief that the dragon reborn had broken every bond that held them. They hunched against the cold, faces haggard and defeated, and let themselves be buffeted by the flow of others around them. Watching a dull-eyed woman stagger through the crowd, clutching a small child on her shoulder, Elaine fumbled a coin from her purse and handed it to one of the guards, an apple-cheeked woman with cold eyes. Tsaigan claimed to be from Gildan, the daughter of a minor noble. Well, she might be Gildanan, at least. When the guardswoman leaned down to proffer the coin, the woman with her child staggered on by, unheeding, unseeing. There were too many in the city like that. The palace fed thousands every day at kitchens set up throughout the city, but too many could not even summon the energy to collect their bread and soup. Elaine offered a prayer for mother and child as she dropped the coin back into her purse. "You cannot feed everyone," Saritha offered quietly. "Children are not allowed to starve in Andor," Elaine said, as if issuing a decree. But she did not know how to stop it. Food was still plentiful in the city, but no command could force people to eat. Some of the other foreigners had come to Camelin that way, too, men and women who no longer wore rags and haunted faces. Whatever had sent them flying from their homes, they had begun thinking that they had traveled far enough, thinking about the trades they had abandoned, often along with everything they possessed. In Camelin, though, anyone with skill in a craft and a little drive could always find a banker with ready coin. There were new trades being followed in the city these days. She had seen 3 clockmakers' shops already this morning. Within her sight were 2 shops selling blown glass, and nearly 30 manufactories had been built north of the city. From now on, Camelin would export glass, not import it, and crystal as well. The city had lace makers now, producing as fine as Lugard ever had, and no wonder, since nearly all of them had come from there. That brightened her mood a little. The taxes those new crafts paid would help, though it would take time before they paid much. Yet it was still others in the crowds she noticed most. Foreign or Andoran, the mercenaries were easily picked out, hard-faced men wearing swords, swaggering even when slowed to a crawl by the press. Merchants' guards also went armed, rough fellows shouldering aside most men who got in their way, but they seemed subdued and sober compared to the sellswords. And on the whole, they displayed fewer scars. Mercenaries dotted the crowd like raisins in a cake. With such a large pool to draw on, and with winter employment for their skills always in short supply, she did not think they would come too dear, unless, as Dailin feared, they cost her Andor. Somehow she had to find enough men that foreigners were not a majority in the guards, and the money to pay them. Abruptly she became aware of Birgitta. The other woman was angry. She often was, of late, and coming closer. Very angry, and coming very quickly. An ominous combination that set alarm gongs ringing in Elaine's head. Immediately she ordered a return to the palace by the most direct route. That would be how Birgitta was coming. The bond would lead her straight to Elaine. and they took the next turn south onto Needle Street. It was actually a rather wide street, though it meandered like a river, down one hill and up the next, but generations ago it had been full of needlemakers. Now a few small inns and taverns were jammed among cutlers and tailors and every sort of shop except needlemakers. Before they had even reached the inner city, Birgitta found them climbing Pearman's Lane, where a handful of fruit sellers still clung to shops handed down since the days of Ishara, though there was precious little to be seen in their windows this time of year. Despite the crowd, Birgitta cantered into sight, red cloak flaring behind, scattering people before her left and right, and only slowed her rangy gray when she saw them ahead. As if to make up for her hurry, she took a moment to study the guardswomen and return Casella's salute before turning her mount to walk beside Elaine's. Unlike them, she wore neither sword nor armor. The memories of her past lives were fading. She said she could remember nothing at all clearly before the founding of the White Tower now, though fragments still floated up. But one thing she claimed to recall absolutely. Every time she had tried to use a sword, she had nearly gotten herself killed, and had even done so more than once. Her strung bow was in a leather saddle case, though, with a bristling quiver of arrows on the other side. Anger boiled in her, and she wore a frown that only deepened as she spoke. "A half-frozen pigeon flew into the palace coat a little while ago, with word from Arangil. The men escorting Nayan and Elenia were ambushed and killed not 5 miles out of the town. Luckily, one of their horses came back with blood on the saddle, or we'd have known nothing for weeks yet. I doubt our luck extends to that pair being held for ransom by brigands." Fireheart pranced a few steps, and Elaine reined him in sharply. Someone in the crowd shouted what might have been a cry for Trakand. Or not. Shopkeepers trying to attract custom raised enough din to muffle the words. "So we have a spy in the palace," she said, then compressed her lips, wishing she had held her tongue in front of Saritha. Birgitta did not seem to care. "Unless there's a Taviran trotting around we don't know about," she replied dryly. "Maybe now you'll let me assign a bodyguard. Just a few guards, well chosen, and no!" The palace was her home. She would not be guarded there. Glancing at the brown, she sighed. Saritha was listening very attentively. There was no point in trying to hide things now. Not this. "You let the first maid know?" Birgitta gave her a sidelong look that, combined with a burst of mild outrage through their shared bond, told her to go teach her grandmother to knit. "She intends to question every servant who didn't serve your mother at least 5 years. I'm not sure she doesn't mean to put them to the question. The look on her face when I told her I was glad to get out of her study with a whole skin. I'm looking at others myself." She meant the guards, but she would not say so in hearing of Casella and the others. Elaine did not think it likely. All the recruiting gave anyone a perfect opportunity to slip in eyes and ears, yet without any assurance they would ever be where they could learn anything useful. "If there are spies in the palace," Saritha said quietly, "there may be worse. Perhaps you should accept the Lady Birgitta's suggestion of a bodyguard. There is precedent." Birgitta showed the brown sister her teeth. As a smile, it was a miserable failure. However much she disliked being addressed by her title, however, she turned hopeful eyes on Elaine. "I said no, and I mean no," Elaine snapped. A beggar approaching the slow-moving circle of horses with a wide, gap-toothed grin and his cap in his hand flinched and scurried away into the throng before she could even think of reaching for her purse. She was not sure how much of her anger was her own and how much Brigitte's, but it was appropriate. "I should have gone to get them myself," she growled bitterly. Instead, she had woven a gateway for the messenger and spent the rest of the day meeting with merchants and bankers. "At the least I should have stripped the garrison at Arangil for escort. 10 men dead because I blundered. Worse, the light help me, it is worse. I've lost Elenia and Nayan because of it." Brigitte's thick golden braid hanging outside her cloak swung as she shook her head emphatically. "In the first place, queens don't go running off to do everything themselves. They're bloody queens." Her anger was dying down a little, but irritation flared on top of it, and her tone reflected both. She really wanted Elaine to have a bodyguard. very likely even in her bath. Your adventuring days are done. The next thing you'd be sneaking out of the palace in disguise, maybe even wandering around after nightfall when you might get your skull cracked open by some tough you never even saw. Elaine sat up straight in her saddle. Brigida knew, of course. She did not know any way to get around the bond, though she was sure there must be one, but the woman had no right to bring it up now. If Brigida offered enough hints, she would have other sisters trying to follow her with their warders and likely squads of guardsmen as well. Everyone was so ridiculous about keeping her safe. You would think she had never been in Ebu Dar, much less Tanchico or Falma. Besides, she had only done it once. So far. And Avienda went with her. "Cold, dark streets don't compare to a warm fire and an interesting book," Saritha put in idly, as if talking to herself. Studying the shops they were passing, she seemed intent on them. "I very much dislike walking on icy pavement myself, especially in the dark, without so much as a candle. Young, pretty women often think plain clothes and a dirty face make them invisible." The shift was so sudden, with no change in tone, that at first Elaine did not realize what she was hearing. "Being knocked down and dragged into an alley by drunken rowdies is a hard way to learn differently. Of course, if you are lucky enough to have a friend with you who also can channel, if she's lucky enough that the tough fails to hit her as hard as he should, well, you cannot be lucky every time. Wouldn't you agree, Lady Brigida?" Elaine closed her eyes for a moment. Avienda had said someone was following them, but she had been sure it was only a footpad. Anyway, it had not been like that. Not exactly. Brigida's glare promised a talking to later. She refused to understand that a warder just did not dress down her Aes Sedai. "In the second place," Brigida went on grimly, 10 men or nearly 300, the bloody outcome would have been the bloody same. Burn me, it was a good plan. A few men could have brought Nayun and Elania to Camelin unnoticed. Emptying out the garrison would have pulled every flaming eye in the east of Andor, and whoever took them would have brought enough armsmen to be sure. Very likely they'd hold Arengil now on top of it. Small as the garrison is, Arengil keeps anybody who wants to move against you in the east off balance, and the more guards who come out of Cairhien, the better that gets, since they're nearly all loyal to you. For someone who claimed to be a simple archer, she had a good grasp of the situation. The only thing she had left out was the loss of the customs duties from the river trade. "Who did take them, Lady Brigida?" Saritha asked, leaning to look past Elaine. "Surely that is a very important question." Brigida sighed loudly, almost a whimper. "We will know soon enough, I fear," Elaine said. The brown quirked a doubting eyebrow at her, and she tried not to grind her teeth. She seemed to be doing that quite a lot since coming home. A Tarabonner woman in a green silk cloak stepped out of the way of the horses and made a deep curtsy, her thin beaded braids swinging out of her cowl. Her maid, a diminutive woman with her arms full of small packages, imitated her mistress awkwardly. The two wide men close behind, guards carrying brass ferruled quarterstaffs, remained upright and alert. Their long, heavy leather coats would turn all but the most determined thrust of a knife. Elaine inclined her head as they rode by to acknowledge the Tarabonner's courtesy. She had not received as much from any Andoran in the streets so far. The handsome face behind the woman's sheer veil showed too much age to be Aes Sedai. Light, she had too much on her plate to be worrying about Elida now. "It is very simple, Saritha," she said in a carefully controlled voice. "If Jared Sarand took them, Elania will give Nayun a choice. Declare Aron for Elania with some sweetening of estates for Nayun in return, or else have her throat slit in a quiet cell somewhere and her corpse buried behind a barn. Nayun won't give in easily, but her house is arguing over who is in charge until she returns, so they'll dither. Elania will threaten torture and maybe use it, and eventually Aron will stand behind Sarand for Elania. Soon to be joined by Anshar and Baran. They will go where they see strength. If Nayon's people have them, she will offer the same choices to Elania. But Jared will go on a rampage against Aron unless Elania tells him not to, and she won't, if she thinks he has any hope of rescuing her. So we must hope to hear in the next few weeks that Aron estates are being burned. If not, she thought, I have four houses united to face, and I still don't know whether I really have even two." "That is very nicely reasoned out," Saritha said, sounding faintly surprised. "I'm sure you could have two with time," Elaine said, too sweetly, and felt a stab of pleasure when the other sister blinked. Light! Her mother would have expected her to see that much when she was 10. The rest of the ride back to the palace passed in silence, and she barely noticed the bright mosaic towers and grand vistas of the inner city. Instead, she thought about Aes Sedai and Camelin and spies in the royal palace, about who had Elania and Neyon, and how much Brigitte could step up recruiting, about whether it was time to sell the palace's plate and the rest of her gems. A gloomy list to consider, but she kept her face smooth and serenely acknowledged the scant cheers that followed her. A queen should not show herself afraid, especially when she was. The royal palace was a pure white confection of intricately worked balconies and columned walks atop the highest hill of the inner city, the highest in Camelin. Its slender spires and gilded domes loomed against the midday sky, visible for miles, proclaiming the power of Andor. Grand entrances and departures were made at the front, at the Queen's Plaza, where in the past great crowds had gathered to hear the proclamations of queens and shout their acclaim for Andor's rulers. Elaine entered at the rear of the palace, Fireheart's steel-shod hooves ringing on the paving stones as she trotted into the main stable yard. It was a broad space fronted on two sides by the rows of the tall arched doors of the stables, overlooked by a single long white stone balcony, plain and sturdy. Several of the high columned walks offered partial views from above, but this was a working palace. In front of the simple colonnade that gave entry to the palace itself, a dozen guardsmen preparing to replace those on duty in the plaza stood rigidly beside their horses, being inspected by their under-lieutenant, a grizzled fellow with a limp, who had been a bannerman under Garath Bryn. Along the outer wall, 30 more were mounting, ready to begin patrols of the inner city in pairs. In normal days, there would have been guardsmen whose main duty was policing the streets, but with numbers so reduced, those who protected the palace had to do that as well. Carianna Francie was there as well, a stocky woman in an elegant green-striped riding dress and blue-green cloak, sitting her gray gelding, while one of her warders, Venner Cosan, climbed onto his bay. Dark, with touches of gray in his tight-curled hair and beard, the blade-slim man wore a plain brown cloak. Apparently they did not mean to advertise who they were. Elaine's arrival brought a flash of surprise to the stable-yard. Not to Carianna or Cosan, of course. The green sister merely looked thoughtful in the sheltering cowl of her cloak, and Cosan not even that. He simply nodded to Brigitte and Yarman, warder to warder. Without another glance, they rode out as soon as the last of Elaine's escort cleared the iron-strapped gates. But some of those mounting along the wall paused with one foot in a stirrup, staring, and heads whipped toward the new arrivals among the men standing inspection. She had not been expected back for another hour at least, and excepting a few who never thought beyond what their hands were doing, everyone in the palace knew the situation was volatile. Rumors spread among soldiers even faster than among other men, and the light knew that was saying something, the way men gossiped. These had to know that Brigitte had departed in a hurry, and now she returned with Elaine ahead of time. Was one of the other houses marching on Camelin, ready to attack? Were they to be ordered to the walls that they could not man completely, even with what Dailin had in the city? Moments of surprise and worry. Then the leathery under-lieutenant barked a command, and eyes snapped straight ahead, arms swept across chests in salute. Only three besides the former bannerman had been on the rolls a few days gone, but there were no raw recruits here. Grooms in red coats with the white line embroidered on one shoulder came rushing out from the stable, though in fact there was little for them to do. The guardswomen quietly dismounted at Brigitte's order and began leading their horses through the tall doors. She herself leaped from her saddle and tossed her reins to one of the grooms, and she was no quicker than Yarman, who hurried to hold Saritha's bridle while she climbed down. He was what some sisters called fresh caught, bonded less than a year, the term dated from a time when warders had not always been asked whether they wanted the bond, and he was very assiduous in his duties. Birgitta just stood scowling, fists on her hips, apparently watching the men who would patrol the inner city for the next 4 hours ride out in a column of twos. Elaine would have been surprised if those men more than crossed Brigida's mind, though. In any event, she had her own worries. Trying not to be obvious about it, she studied the wiry woman who held Fireheart's bridle, and the stocky fellow who put down a leather-covered mounting stool and held her stirrup as she dismounted. He was unsmilingly stolid and deliberate, while she was wrapped up in stroking the gelding's nose and whispering to him. Neither really looked at Elaine beyond a respectful bow of the head. Courtesies came second to making sure she was not tossed from the saddle by a horse made skittish by bobbing people. No matter that she had no need of their help. She was not in the country any longer, and there were forms to be followed. Even so, she tried not to frown. Leaving them as they led Fireheart away, she did not look back. But she wanted to. The windowless entry hall beyond the colonnade seemed dim, though a few of the mirrored stand lamps were lit. Plain lamps here, the iron worked into simple scrolls. Everything was utilitarian, the plastered cornices unadorned, the white stone walls bare and smooth. Word of their arrival had spread, and before they were well inside, half a dozen men and women appeared, bowing and curtsying to take cloaks and gloves. Their livery differed from the stable folks in having white collars and cuffs, and the Lion of Andor on the left breast rather than the shoulder. Elaine did not recognize anyone on duty today. Most servants in the palace were new, and others had come out of retirement to take the places of those frightened off when Rand captured the city. A bald, bluff-faced fellow did not quite meet her eyes, but he might have feared it would be too forward. A slender young woman with a squint put too much enthusiasm into her curtsy and her smile, but perhaps she simply wanted to show eagerness. Elaine walked away, followed by Brigitte, before she began glaring at them. Suspicion had a bitter taste. Saritha and her warder left them after a few paces, the brown murmuring an excuse about books she wanted to see in the library. The collection was not small, though nothing in comparison to the great libraries, and she spent hours there every day, frequently pulling up age-worn volumes she said were unknown elsewhere. Yarman heeled her as she glided off down a crossing hallway, a dark, stocky swan drawing a strangely graceful stork in her wake. He still carried his disturbing cloak, carefully folded over one arm. Warders rarely let those out of their own hands for long. Kosan's likely was in his saddlebags. "Would you like a warder's cloak, Brigitte?" Elaine asked, walking on. Not for the first time she envied Brigitte her voluminous trousers. Even divided skirts made an effort of anything beyond a sedate pace. At least she had on riding boots instead of slippers. The bare red and white floor tiles would have been freezing in slippers. There were not enough carpets to layer in the halls as well as in the rooms. They would have been worn out in no time anyway, just from the constant traffic of servants keeping up the palace. "As soon as Egwene has the tower, I will have one made for you. You should have one." "I don't care about flaming cloaks," Brigitte replied grimly. A foreboding scowl set her mouth in a hard line. "It was over so fast, I thought you'd just bloody stumbled and hit your bloody head. Blood and ashes, knocked down by street toughs. The light only knows what might have happened."
"There is no need to apologize, Brigitte."
Outrage and indignation began flooding through the bond, but she meant to seize the advantage. Brigitte's chiding was bad enough in private. She was not about to put up with it in the halls, with servants all around, scurrying by on errands, polishing the carved wall panels, tending stand lamps that were gilded here. They barely paused to offer silent curtsies to Brigitte and her, but doubtless everyone was wondering why the Captain General looked like a thunderhead and had their ears wide to catch whatever they could. "You were not there because I didn't want you there. I'll wager Saritha didn't have Ned with her." It hardly seemed possible that Brigitte's face could darken more. Perhaps mentioning Saritha was a mistake. Elaine changed the subject.
"You really must do something about your language. You're beginning to sound like the worst sort of layabout."
"My language?" Brigitte murmured dangerously. Even her strides changed to something like a pacing leopard. "You talk about my language? At least I always know what the words I use mean. At least I know what fits where and what doesn't."
Elaine colored, and her neck stiffened. She did know. Most of the time. Often enough, at least. As for Yarman, Birgitta went on, her voice still soft and still dangerous. He's a good man, but he isn't over being goggle-eyed that he's a warder yet. He probably jumps when Saritha snaps her fingers. I was never goggle-eyed, and I don't jump. Is that why you saddled me with a title? Did you think it would rein me in? Wouldn't have been the first silly thought in that head of yours. For someone who thinks so clearly most of the time. Well, I have a writing desk buried in flaming reports I have to shovel through if you're going to get even half the guards you want. But we'll have a good long talk tonight. My lady, she added, much too firmly. Her bow was almost mockingly formal. She stalked away, and her long golden braid should have been bristling like an angry cat's tail. Elaine stamped her foot in frustration. Birgitta's title was a well-earned reward, earned 10 times over just since she bonded the woman, and 10,000 times over before that. Well, she had thought of the other, but not until afterwards. Much good it had done, anyway. Whether from Lady or Aes Sedai, Birgitta chose which commands she obeyed. Not when it was important. Not when she thought it was important, anyway, but over anything else, especially what she called unnecessary risks or improper behavior. As if Birgitta Silverbow could talk to anyone about taking risks. And as for proper behavior, Birgitta caroused in taverns. She drank and gambled, and ogled pretty men to boot. She enjoyed looking at the pretty ones, even if she did prefer those who looked as if they had been beaten about the head often. Elaine did not want to change her. She admired the woman, liked her, counted her a friend. But she wished there were a little more of warder to Aes Sedai in their relationship, and much less of knowing older sister to scampish younger. Abruptly she realized that she was standing there scowling at nothing. Servants hesitated as they went by, and tucked their heads down as if afraid she might be glaring at them. Smoothing her face, she gestured to a gangling, pimply-faced boy coming down the hall. He bowed so awkwardly and so deeply that he staggered and almost fell over. "Find Mistress Harfour and ask her to see me immediately in my apartments," she told him, then added in a not unkindly voice, "And you might remember your superiors won't be pleased if they find you gawking at the palace when you should be working." His mouth dropped open as though she had read his mind. Perhaps he thought she had. His wide eyes flashed to her great serpent ring, and he squeaked and made an even deeper bow before darting away at a dead run. She smiled in spite of herself. It had been a wild stab, but he was too young to be anyone's spy, and too nervous not to be up to something he should not. On the other hand, her smile faded. On the other hand, he was not that much younger than she.